Did you ever wonder what it takes to bring innovation from Europe and China to the global life science industry? If your answer is yes, then this conversation number 67 with Kai Lamotke is right for you.
What is our picture in the future about society? How should we set it up? That maybe something like happiness is a key asset about how we run our society.
This episode was recorded in November 2021, and we were talking about how to bring science into business. Bicode's mission, finding the right business model for a company, how to establish business between continents, and how it is to operate systems in a pandemic world. Kai Lamotke is the co-founder and CEO of Bicol Limited and Bicol Biotechnology in Shanghai, the first German-Chinese biotechnology company. His expertise and knowledge in life science and innovation sectors in China and Europe are requested by corporates, SMEs, and organizations like the European Commission. The excessive network of business, academic, and political contacts allowed him to achieve business governmental grants with a value of over 23 million euros up to now. I hope you enjoy the conversation the same way as I did. Enjoy the show. Welcome to a new episode of my podcast, and I'm very happy today to have a friend from Munich in the show, Kai Lamotke from Germany. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Christian. And for sure, it's more than a pleasure to interact with you, try to create an understanding about what we have done, contribute for some insight.
It's great to see you. I think it's been 2 years since we met the last time. How is it going in Munich, in Germany?
Yeah, so everybody is somehow suffering pandemic impact, and for sure, meeting people in real life becomes a little bit problematic, but in virtual life, it's a little bit more easy. But I think, or I believe also, science is about communication. Science is about interaction. Science is about team playing. And you really have to meet people. Otherwise, progress is somehow so-so, I would describe it.
That's absolutely true. I mean, there are two things that I like with the pandemic, if I may say so. One thing is the digital push. About meeting people, when I think back before 2020, there was mostly no acceptance of digital means of communication. And when I interact with people today, I think the awareness that a lot of communication can be also done very quickly, where the internet has grown in the last 18 months. How do you see that?
I meet also spontaneously people with this virtual meeting. Before it was telephone calls, but I don't know if people are still understand how to call. So it's interesting that I'm in a different kind of lunch meetings. So yesterday, a professor from Zurich called me for a lunch meeting, and we were just chatting 1 hour. So this is somehow has turned to really virtual meetings, not telephone calls any longer. And there is still a hesitation barrier to start virtual meeting with unknown people. So you really have to fix a date before you start. And that can be a hurdle for some people. So spontaneous virtual meetings are still very rare. Mm-hmm. So when we established our company, Bicol, we established this a lot with this kind of digital tools we are now permanently relying on. So our mantra was, wherever you are in front of a computer, you can do such kind of communication and you should do it. Yeah, so from the establishment at that time, Skype was a regular tool. We have done also this kind of regular meetings. Still, it was necessary to be at the site of Shanghai every 6 to 8 weeks because of this kind of personal interaction. But like you describe it, it's now so common that people are accepting it like a real meeting. Actually, it's not a real meeting, but they accept it like a real meeting.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. I mean, I was mostly on conferences. This is where I met you and your company. I think it was quite normal to have spontaneous meetings and follow up then digitally, so via phone calls or Zoom calls already. But for most people, I think they also preferred the regular common meetings, phone calls, or just sharing a cup of coffee somewhere in a cafe and talking about business. The second thing that I observed in the last 18 months was that the common understanding of how drug development process in general work has become a little bit better, especially with the tremendous successes of Pfizer and Moderna, for example. I read last week that Pfizer also now has a therapeutic that is coming to the market, developed in my opinion, less than 12 months from scratch to the market. But one thing, and this was the reason why I invited you to the show, one thing I think needs still a little bit more communication to create a better understanding for everybody on how it really works, that drugs are developed, especially in the early stages. And I'm very happy to have you here. And maybe we start with sharing a little bit of your background, where you got your expertise and what you are actually doing in the drug discovery stages.
So from education, I'm a chemist. And chemistry-wise, for sure, I analyze the world. And that is also the setup, like we ask questions and we become answers. If I say chemistry, I'm related or rely on small molecules in this kind of questions. So from my education, I did some studies in US, in Berkeley, as well then in Munich. And for sure, I have had early on natural products were a favorable topic for me, because for me, on one hand side, at that time, they looked complex but still working. And you have to ask yourself, okay, there are natural compounds; they might have a certain kind of complexity. But they are working, and especially working for plants. Plants, natural compounds are tremendously successful in a starting point for any drug discovery approach, and also successful on the market. So half of the top 200 drugs are derived from natural products, and the majority is from plants. So, and that was part of my education. And then at that time, combinatorial chemistry was in fashion, and people were dealing with numbers. So I remember that I have a certain kind of a strategic outlook from Bayer at that time. So that was 25 years ago, where they say, oh, we are pretty successful. If we do 20,000 compounds, we bring one compound to the market. So the numbers is easy. Just make 40,000 compounds and you bring two compounds to the market. And then I said, at that time, was it really so easy? Was it just a number game? And combinatorial chemistry was all about number games. And I couldn't believe it. And then I have had a lot of discussions for sure with industrial colleagues at that time, as well as colleagues there where I studied. And we said that can be a very difficult and also dangerous path we are going there, that quality of the starting point was not an issue any longer. Mm-hmm. So quantity was an issue, and it might be also driven by decision makers, maybe more with a business administrative background, so very strong analytic capabilities and understanding, okay, maybe it's a number game, just try it. And at the end, we figured out it might be not a number game, it's a quality game. Okay. And this kind of quality game we need to address. So I remember also then some 15 years ago where I gave a talk at a big pharmaceutical company. And there was a discussion about if we should think about in medicinal chemistry, think about introduction of non-flat compounds. With a stereocenter, which is for sure a certain kind of degree of difficulty for any chemist to introduce one or two stereocenters. But at the end, what you picture, if you have an enzyme and you think you want to increase activity or decrease activity, if you want to influence a human disease, at the end, this is a three-dimensional body, and for sure, the likelihood that your small molecule, where you want to influence it, it's also a high chance that this one has some three dimensions, and flat compounds have a certain kind of charm, but I would describe it, reality is more on the side of three-dimensional setup also at small molecules.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, reality seems to be a little bit more complex than models. I completely can emphasize with the statistics games that usually business people like myself are doing to just look from the outside into systems and figure out if I turn a little bit here, what happens in the end, and make it a numbers game, which might not really always be the reality. What I find very interesting, especially when we talk about education and people's decision. I mean, when I studied in the 90s in Graz and did some economical studies, the usual pathway was get a master's degree. Either you stay on universities and do some research and go down the academic route, or you leave the university and find a secure job in a big corporation and work up the ladder until you retire somewhere in the 60s. And some people did different things. And as far as I understand from your CV, you decided to found a company. And what I find particularly interesting is this decision point. What made you going? What made you decide? What was the drive? What the initial event where you said, okay, no, I make my own company.
Okay, so let's make first a decision why why I didn't went to academia, and maybe there's also a funny story because I was studying in Berkeley. And there I lived together with a colleague. He was doing his postdoc there, and we were thinking about, is academia something like we should aim for? And then I reflect my own understanding about the setup of a professor, and I said, I think I'm not clever enough for becoming a professor. And then he said to me, I have learned if you ask you this kind of question already, you are not meant to become a professor, because you should be really self-confident that you can make it. But that was a joke for sure. And if you ask why becoming an entrepreneur, I think I found it fascinating to develop something. I found it fascinating to be fully responsible for something. I found it interesting also to develop people, to form a team, to have this kind of certain feedback also from team members. And I also found it fascinating that you have the potential to scale up a business dramatically if you identify certain kind of solutions, which I would describe the market needs and want to have it. And under this kind of setup and the permanent pressure on efficiency topics, the permanent pressure on limited resources, you try to build up something which is inherent, sustainable, and functional. And so reality, like you said, sometimes it's hard to negotiate with reality, which we always see now also for people in opposed to public decision processes currently. Sometimes reality is hard to negotiate, but you can adapt to reality, and then you can ask yourself, okay, what is reality telling you for your own setup? And so that might be some inherent driving motivations for going to found a company, and why it's also appealing, because I would describe it as a different life form. You can go for that or you can't go for that. But I somehow decided it's pretty interesting, and especially the step into China in 2000 was challenging by itself.
I can completely agree to what you say. I think for me, it's always so, I divide it in three mindsets and three different personalities. One is the creative academic side, which comes up with a lot of great ideas. Then we have the huge corporate side of life, which is very structured and process-driven and organized. And in between, as you describe, I think it's particularly interesting for certain personalities to take ideas, to figure out how to turn ideas into products, then figuring out the next step, where do you find the right people to make the idea bigger? Because usually one person can do a lot, but not everything alone. And putting together then right people, form the first team, scale it up, hand it over to big corporations like in the pharma industry is an exciting process to me. And of course, there are mixtures of these personalities. But if you, and I consider you are also one of those entrepreneurs who find pleasure in turning ideas into products, form their own company. What is Bcall doing actually? What is your company's purpose?
So our company's purpose is to create small molecules to create benefit for human application in the sense of either identifying novel treatment options or to create novel treatment options for disease. We are also in the area of in the food area. We are also in the agro business area. And there we, with our competence of small molecule creation in the sense of starting from natural products, as well as manipulation in the sense of making patentable compounds available, we have found our company Bcall. And this is also our core competence in analytical chemistry, as well as natural product chemistry, as well as medicinal chemistry. Mm-hmm. And with this kind of core competence, we are looking for partners who have a cutting edge understanding about mode of actions, novel models, how to achieve new therapeutics, having a screening system, test systems available, who can deliver with our competence then the next generation of a product. Mm-hmm.
That's very exciting to hear. There is one point as a business-minded person that I find interesting additionally. Putting together a team and structuring what you're doing is the first step. And the second step then is finding the right business model. And I experienced a few different kinds of business models. And what I find very interesting is the process of how people come to the actual model they operate in. And if I may, would like to ask the question, how did you find your business model?
Yeah, so it's really a process because you drive, you describe a little bit how organizations are set up. And if you start from scratch, you have the freedom also, or the choice, or the must also, to structure a company. And in the structuring process, there is also the idea of business model inherent lying there, which you need to identify. And the interesting thing is also to see the development over the last 20 years of our company Bicol was that the business model has changed. And in the beginning, we were set up with a grant from a governmental organization. So we were looking for resources, in this case, money, to create this kind of company where the headquarter is located here in Germany and the 100% daughter company in China. And we found it with a grant called Public-Private Partnership. And your question was going into the business model, and we were perfectly serving this kind of grant need at that time. But then we need to switch to business. And also this switching to business and producing a product where there is market need creates certain kind of mindset change also for our colleagues. And I would describe this mindset change takes a while. Mm-hmm. And then also to identify, okay, how you really can serve the market. What kind of contribution can you give into the development process, what the market is somehow honoring with your achievement. So drug discovery for sure is highly complex and it's highly interesting. And there are a lot of ideas we can follow. Unfortunately, not all the kind of ideas you can put into a business model. And sometimes we are sitting together and say, oh, that would be interesting to do, and that would be interesting to do. And we think, okay, this and that needs also a solution, but you cannot create a business model for it. And a business model is mostly about also repetition, because you do not have clients who are coming enthusiastically to you and say, you are a great team. We give you an unlimited amount of money, just create a solution. It's mostly that the investment has to already be done. And the contribution is then related to the investment you have done and package it in a form that your partner can further progress with this kind of contribution, and then for sure also create additional added value. So I think theoretically this is a process, and for sure if I would look onto in this kind of development process as an interesting person, I would say, oh, there are a lot of other ideas we could follow. But as I said, to create a business model, this is a challenge by itself.
That's absolutely true. And I think you gave a wonderful explanation of the beautiful world of entrepreneurship. To take an idea and give it a direction, and especially figuring out what is the actual market need and can your product serve the market need? And then on top of that, is there also a willingness to pay? Which you pointed out, the customers are not coming happily, willingly, and throw money at you. So you need also to work on connecting their problem to your solution and explaining it in a way that they very easily understand if they purchase your product, that their solution is there, that they need to solve their problem, which is, in my opinion, not very easy. And I also like the point where you pointed out that it's sort of also mindset shift from thinking transactional, so that you get paid for every hour, towards, as an entrepreneur, I invest in building a solution where it's rewarded later on. Did I understand your explanation in the right way, or would you like to correct a little bit my perception?
I wouldn't correct it, but I would go more in detail. And I just can give you again this kind of long development cycles, which you have in a drug discovery, drug development. You have shorter development cycles in agrobusiness, and you might have even more shorter development cycles in the food industry. And why I pointed out the development cycle is, and that took me a little bit of thinking how to answer your direction best, is that the question is what you bring on the table for your partner. Where does it count to be an added value for your partner? And because I told you about this kind of development cycles, so development cycle in food industry as well as in agriculture industry are faster. And that means also you see your success faster, or you see also the value of your product faster. And in the drug discovery field, sometimes it's very invisible what kind of contribution really brings the final added value on the table, really delivers a compound which is successful, because it goes through so many hands that also it is not pretty clear for decision makers in big companies where are the success factors, because the feedback loop are just so long. They are sometimes 12 years, and then think about who is in the same position after 12 years, because the success today might have been done by the fourth, fifth generation beforehand, and you are then sitting in the seat, in the driver's seat, and now you are harvesting the wise decision of your forerunners. And so therefore, it's if I really state, okay, we bring for sure also obvious portions of added value to our partner. We see it again, that reality in the process becomes very visible and very clear and very transparent. That can be really shocking news sometimes. So we are working also in de-orphanizing drug targets. And then people are coming to us and they say, oh, we did certain kind of years in doing medicinal chemistry, but we do not have any compound to prove that we are right. And then we delivering them a handful of compounds. And then they can do for the first time animal test. And then they see, oh, wow, all of our hypothesis, is it now true? Is it really having the effect in animals like we assume it should have? Can we do this kind of transfer to treatment to humans, human disease, yes or no? And this will be then an added value for our partners if they are looking for it. Yeah. So that is a little bit then the answer to your indicated question.
I think drug development in the early stages is, how should I say that? In my opinion, mostly understanding to manage the process in a way that you come quickly to a decision-making point. I have not found a better explanation yet. It's not so much delivering the final product. It's much more playing the process in my opinion, in a very quick and efficient way to give the potential customer, client, or investor the possibility to either say, to give a go decision to continue with development or a no-go decision. How is your perception of a description of the magic of drug discovery in business terms?
Yeah, the speed is important. That's for sure. The decision points are also important. So if you make a speed on the wrong decision criteria, you will end up in a very fast process with no result. And that was my indication about the quality of starting point, the quality of checkpoints, the quality of reality. Because you can be very fast in early drug discovery, but then you have to oppose your compound to clinical trials. And then maybe some decision points you could clarify much earlier on that this kind of compound might be not a good one to survive the kind of clinical trials, but you did not include it into your decision process. So your decision process was fast, but not covering all the kind of aspects of what is really a good drug and has it a chance to survive. And that was my indication about why are natural products so tremendously successful also on the top sold drugs on the market, because there is this kind of evolutionary process who has formed and developed already ready available features to survive in a other organism than in a plant or another organism like in a bacteria. And this kind of inherent decision point we use then intentionally or non-intentionally and try to modify it further. In the description, we is our society, and we are pretty good in engineering processes. So means if we have a starting point, we are pretty good in changing in it, modifying it, trying to adapt it. But humans are not very good in creating from scratch. But humans want to be very good in creating in scratch. And there is a discrepancy also in this kind of process about our own perspective of ourselves. And that is, I just can turn it back to this kind of success case of natural products from plant in this kind of top 200 drugs. That is the reason why they are so successful, because they oppose to our capability to engineer problems. And if you have a good starting point, we are very good in engineering. But and also adaption, using knowledge, putting it again together, modify it further, add there something, seldomly remove something. So we are always very good in adding, but very bad in removing, even if it would be more successful. And that is also where the kind of small molecules from plants are a good starting point. And as I said, from scratch, there are a few people who really can do it. They are our heroes and genius. But we might need more from them.
I love what you say. I'm thought it through a couple of days ago that one thing I observed in my life is that I love investing. So when I see, for example, investors like Warren Buffett, it's very easy to imagine to have the end result, as you say. So you just say, okay, this is the result that they want to have, and also to imagine how great it would be to be on the Forbes top 10 list, and not realizing that in between there is a long learning process. And everybody initially must start at scratch. So I think it also resembles what you are saying about the drug development process, that starting from scratch where nothing is, not even a description of the end result initially, First, it needs to find the definition of how the end result should look like. And once people have that, then the amazing thing is to get started, because initially everything is a failure. So when I stay in the investment picture, putting money to work on the stock market looks quite simple when I observe what Warren Buffett did. But everybody who starts investing the first time makes probably every time the same mistake like other people did, and nothing works. And this picture, I think, resembles, in my opinion, also what you say about drug discovery. Initially, when you start with science and turning it into products, probably you have a high failure rate. And it needs a certain type of personality who doesn't value this kind of failure in a negative way and give it a negative drive, but just say, okay, it's part of the learning process. And we learned something. Let's go to the next step. How do you see that description?
Okay, it's a little bit to an earlier question you raised about entrepreneurship and how we are prepared to face such kind of critical factors in the decision process, because if you start to be an entrepreneur, there might be not really buffer. So you can rely on friends, a supporting network. But at the end, it's also learning by yourself and also learning the hard way. Yeah. Because what you see then often, if you hand over a company from generation to generation, it does not mean that the next generation is better or not so good like you. It's maybe more if they have experience, success as well as failure, like you describe it also with investment on the stock market. For sure, it's easier to do investment on the stock market if the market is going up. Yeah, if the central banks are flooding the market with money, and then the money needs to find some way. And then first of all, it finds a way on the stock market. And luckily, all this kind of people who are on the stock market don't want to invest in real goods, because then we would have a high inflation rate. And luckily, maybe they decide, okay, now I have made some money in the virtual world, I would describe it then, in the stock market, and then I go and choose some real investment, and maybe the real investment is popping up then in the pharmaceutical industry. And this kind of then real investment tries to create with available money then a product. So again, starting from scratch, you need some training. I have the feeling that our society and as well as our environment provide too less of this kind of training. It does not provide enough fields of experience for people, because we are buffering everything away. So at the end, somebody else is responsible for everything. And what I found very interesting, a visit of a middle-class household in America, where one of the member was an engineer. On the toilet, he has a thick book about standing up again after a failure. So it was, I don't know, 400 pages of examples where people failed and learn from their failure and starts again. And as I describe it, this kind of acceptance in our society that you want to try it different, and that you try to different with the risk of a failure. And this risk of a failure brings you forward and should not discourage you to go on. I think this kind of attitude we need to develop, because as your intro was today about vaccination and how fast we are able to develop something at least, which is able to help us. Yeah, it's not a perfect solution. And for sure, I'm not sure how perfect it can be in 2 years of a development cycle and 20 years of a development cycle before such kind of product came to the market. Because don't forget, that for sure BioNTech relies on a strong team with a lot of people who have suffered during their academic career about rejection, about this kind of approach they were proposing some 20 years ago. And through this kind of very critical time, luckily, a person survived there. And this was a starting point for the invention of Moderna as well as BioNTech. And Pfizer then, who picked it up, because also there, Pfizer somehow decided, well, it sounds interesting. Let's help this kind of persons, because they helped us to identify a product, but we will push the clinical trials.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
No, I agree to what you say about fair culture. And I mean, this is my explanation personally why scientists make great entrepreneurs, because I think the science training by itself is learning to deal with failures. You have hypothesis, you make an experiment, try it out, it doesn't work. What do you need to change? So should you stop and change direction and run away? Or should you make the next hypothesis and do the next experiment and just try and try again until it works? And this is also necessary in the startup world for entrepreneurs. It's pretty much the same process, in my opinion. What I got from you is that you had proficient in science. You got a great training at Berkeley and in Munich, and decided to found a company, which by itself is a very tough process that you went through. And then you did the third amazing thing. You not only started it in Germany, you decided to head over to China. And if I remember it right, your history with China dates back until the 90s. Can you tell me a little bit more why and how you made this decision to pick up the China opportunity?
Yeah, so maybe I put it then on the chapter of diversity. So very interesting for me. When I did my school in Germany, there was exactly one, call him foreigner. He was an Italian person. He came to our school for 9 months, and that was the only foreigner. And so we went already just previously to setup of a society. If you have very limited diversity, also for problem solution, I think that's the inherent key question about why is diversity anything we should appreciate. It's about problem solution, and diversity can be created about background, can be created about belonging to certain kind of classes or whatever. So you can create diversity in a lot of sense, experience, and so on. As I describe it, I've chosen to go to America during my studies for diploma thesis at that time. So I was studying in Münster, in the north of Germany. And I decided to go there. And I found it also interesting that there in Berkeley, you have had a lot of students from different kind of backgrounds. And a very talented person there was Chinese from Taiwan. And I just asked him, because he was so diligent in how he's handling small scale reactions, that it was just an art. Yeah. And I asked him, can I just stand there and watch you? because you do it so nicely, yeah, in this kind of answer. So this was great, and it opens also my mind towards different kind of backgrounds coming together on working on a similar language, which I call science. Yeah, like you describe. Yeah, what is science and what is chemistry? Making certain kind of or asking certain kind of questions with a setup, and then get some results. And having such kind of things in mind, I came back and did then my PhD in south of Germany. And I was also a post there to another Chinese person from Shanghai at that time. And again, we tried to do the same thing like you described with an experiment. We thought, okay, what is now the direction of the pharmaceutical industry? Is it going in the right direction or might be a little bit dangerous? So I describe it with this combinatorial chemistry fashion at that time. And so this kind of interaction gave us also some understanding about mindset of people, because at the end, diversity is good. But you have to have an understanding about your counterpart. Has he the same mindset? Yeah, is there something which you can follow? In case you cannot follow, can he or she explain you why he is motivated to act like that, that you create an understanding? And then you're coming again to language. So that was also something like where we started today, is do you have a common language that you can create something like, I would describe it like a team result. So is your perspective contributing something? Is the other perspective contributing something? And with this kind of contribution, you feel, wow, that's some added value. Yeah, it's a little bit like it needs to be just 1% faster in Olympics to get a gold medal. The question is, where do you get this 1% from? And if it's just a half of a sentence of a new idea from a person you somehow can understand, then this might be the part of the success. And serendipity or luck or getting the chance, I think it's for sure also an underestimated success factor of entrepreneurs. And so we came at the start of BICO, we came together with four people and tried to decide, so what is possible for us to achieve? And for sure, thinking that we were pretty young at Harald at that time and saying, hey, we want to create the first German-Chinese company in biotech, which actually would be the first European Chinese biotech company, is for sure a little bit bold. And everybody where we were telling that we want to do such kind of bold step was, or they have been at least nice and polite to us. But that was a little bit over the estimation that this can be really reality.
I think what you say, these bold goals, is one of the best signs that I'm talking to a real entrepreneur. Elon Musk, for example, he wants to go to Mars. I mean, it's a very bold goal for private companies. And decades ago, it was mostly governments who followed such goals. And it was Bruce Lee, I think, who said that goals are not always meant to be reached. It's sometimes just something to aim at. And I believe the bigger the goal, the higher you fly in the end of the day. So, I mean, making bold moves is the best sign that entrepreneurs become successful. And you did one of those. And already, I think, if I remember it right, 20 years ago, you started your China journey. How was the world back then?
So you see already that there is a chance that the plane of China will get into the air. So we were starting in Shanghai, and I think there was a huge understanding of the background of each other and in which kind of direction Shanghainese people want to shape their future. And for sure, it was a big new field there. So Shanghai at that point was, it's now the center of the city. And at that point, maybe there have been 50 million. Now in the area of Shanghai, you found around 35 million people. And for sure, they a lot of them have reached middle class, especially in Shanghai. In the beginning, there were a few people, foreign people there, a few people also coming from foreign countries back in 2000 in Shanghai. You have had the feeling that you are wanted, because I think that's also important. Otherwise, the hurdles to progress are just too big if you feel not wanted. And then they are typical for entrepreneurs that they want to realize something. So they don't ask about certain kind of regulations, what to adapt and what not to adapt. And that was in the development phase also there. And you can act pretty quickly. So in case there are certain kind of chances, you just could go there. And again, so I have had a very positive feedback loop with Shanghainese people. They just want to do business, which was great. And they have a certain kind of sense also for people, so that they are interested in you and yourself. And food is great. Yeah. So they understand that besides talking to people with a telephone or a computer, you can also eat together, and you can eat good together. And so that's also a nice surrounding then, progressing with people, forming teams, contributing for development, and create something.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Moving is right up there with death and divorce in the Stress Olympics. But fear not. Turn that box of woes into a crate of woes with moving tips in the Life Beyond Boxes podcast with Premium Q Moving. Dive into the world of hassle-free moves, learn tips and tricks to save on cash and your sanity. Say goodbye to those moving meltdowns and hello to the smooth sailings. Or should we say smooth movings? Tune into Life Beyond Boxes with Premium Q Moving on lifebeyondboxes.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. And with us, unpack the secrets to a stress-free move.
I think it was a bold move. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and the world back then was divided. Borders that were real borders, no common currency, and traveling was particularly difficult. Then in 89, a lot changed, and also China started opening up, and I think started a three decades long bull run to lead the world's economy. What I find interesting back in the 90s was, I mean, the internet merely did not exist until 1994. And communication was, besides not speaking the same language, was pretty challenging. And when I look back into my memories, I think the means of communication really started taking off from 2014-15 onwards with the development of smartphones, tablet, Facebook, and also the transmission technology, 4G, was established globally. How did you manage in your early days the communication between Germany and China 20 years ago?
So I think I wrote my first email in 1994. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I came to Germany and I said, where's my email account? 95? Email account, what the... Okay. So at least don't underestimate 1996. Emails was something like at least common understanding. For sure, telephones, you can call people also in China at that time. So it was possible, maybe expensive, but possible. And for sure, you have to be present there. So luckily, something like airplanes were flying and you could get access to the country and vice versa. So people from China could come also here to Germany. So that was at that time was a lot more easier than today.
Well, nobody expected the pandemic, I guess. So.
I think in 2000, nobody expected that it becomes even more difficult to meet each other than to exchange and communicate with each other. And then something like Skype was also introduced at that time, not a European company, at that time not bought by, I think, Microsoft. In the meantime, something like from Lithuania or something East European. Communication tool, which we were starting using. And I think since 2005, if I remember right, this kind of daily communication, we have used such kind of tools. And at the end, communication is about added values. You don't communicate with somebody, or you can communicate about if you have fun. So that's okay. Yeah. So fun communication always is something like you should take into account. But to communicate more often, there should be some added value. And to organize, for sure, the company as well as to bring it forward, such kind of communication tool in front of your laptop was necessary. But at the end, the place where you were on your laptop was not really important. And so I would describe all the tools were available for us since 2005, and there was no change for us, actually. Also, what we do now and what we did 4 years ago. So since 15 years, we are trying to create a common sense that the place where you located not necessarily has to do something with the input you are giving. For sure, you need a lab, and also there, for sure, you need to be people where they are localized. But at least also for these people, 30% of the time they can spend wherever they want to spend their time. And actually, we have never have had desktops in our company. So we just run the company from notebooks from the beginning, just to say, also to have a mindset where you put switch it on, it doesn't mean that you need this specific desk. Yeah. If you need to take it somewhere else, take it. Yeah. Just do it. And so, it's like you indicate. So if you start from scratch, you can for sure rethink about approaches again, and try to organize and form a company together with your team members in the direction what is really essential, what is efficient, how do you want to see and form also your environment, yeah?
It's a little bit walking down memory lane for me when you mentioned 1994, first email, and then also the time of 2005. I was in merger acquisition in an Austrian company back then, responsible for Eastern Europe. And I remember this horrific roaming fees that we paid. So a phone call or several phone calls for a few hours were in the thousands of euros in those days, not in China, not from China, but from Hungary or Czech Republic or Slovakia or Romania, just back to Austria or Germany. And when I look at communication today, it's mostly zero expenses. And even today, with these eSIM cards, before I start traveling somewhere, before the pandemic, I could easily get my access to the local network when I was in Austria. And upon leaving the plane, I could turn on the phone and had perfect access, which I would say, compared to thousands of euros in 2005, is at zero expenses today. Also, you mentioned notebooks and laptops. I mean, when I compare tablets, which we have today, with what we called notebook or laptop back in 2004-05 is a little bit different. It's technology advanced tremendously and made communication very easy. But unfortunately, in 2020, things changed and the world shut down. How did you manage in your company, in your business, that traveling between Germany and China became a little bit, in my opinion, challenging?
Yeah, luckily we have established infrastructure, a common understanding, a stable team at that time. So 75% of our team members are now longer than 10 years at Bicor. So that's something like an achievement, mm-hmm. also in China. And so person understood each other pretty well. And in China, the occurrence of the virus was some months earlier than in Germany. So there was for sure the same insecureness about what we need to expect. Also with my Chinese colleagues. there was also a shutdown for sure in Shanghai at that time because nobody understood how fast virus infection are spreading and how easily you can get infected. And then there was for sure an analysis of the situation and interpretation what we can do and also in conclusion what we should do. And luckily we could communicate, so I could also get away some, call it panic feelings, which everybody had at that time. So what really will happen, what can happen? And it took us, I think, some 10 days after we got operational again. So we were one of the earliest companies who were allowed also to start, mainly because one of our research topics was antiviral compounds at that time. And so if you look backwards, for sure there was a shutdown, a prolongation of Chinese New Year of 2 weeks, maybe then an additional 1 week and 3 days. And then we were normally starting with all the measurements in place, what you have done at that time. And as we were discussing already, a lot has to do with established communication channels and the possibility to reach out and to talk and to form a common agreement what is possible in the next weeks and the next days, yeah, what can happen, yeah, and how should we prepare it, yeah. And so, for examples, everybody has had laptops, notebooks, whatever, we could get it out and work at home. So, yeah, so that was possible immediately. So there were in between 10 minutes, you could create a virtual company as you are starting in the first 10 days.
Let me ask you one question about work life and culture in China and to compare it with Europe. When I remember my first days in my career, it was mostly here in Europe going to the office, ideally before 9 o'clock, and staying in the office as a motivated young professional, ideally leaving not as the first person, would say it that way. And everything happened in the office. And then with the development of modern technology, the digital world, already before the pandemic, there was a huge transition from office-based work to more flexible models. And I think with the pandemic, it got a tremendous push towards flexibility, where people, as you said, just pick up the notebook, sit somewhere on the beach, get the job done, then enjoy private life and do the next project and the next task a couple of hours later. This is my European point of view. And what is your point of view on the European work culture? And what did you learn about the Chinese work culture, about the evolvement and development in the last 20 years?
I believe that we are humans. That if you analyze new things, your brain normally analyzes a difference and not the similarities. And because you try to analyze the difference first and not the similarities, you think, the situation is totally different. So you don't start to say, hey, I'm in a new situation. Let's start to analyze what is not new. And then you start to going and do this kind of analysis. And then you would say, 95% is not really different. So the difference is only the 5%. But the 5% turns out for your perception on reality as very important. And describing so, for me, I'm not seeking first a difference. I'm seeking the similarities in what is really different. And for me, it was very interesting to see, and it happens the same to me. So don't worry, I'm also there, a normal human. If you were the first week in China at that time, and
it's pretty fine as long as I don't send me an invoice for psychoanalysis. So just go ahead.
And at that time, if visitors were coming, they have had an unsecureness on their face for 1 week. And whatever you do with them, they were totally unsecure, or let's call it unsecure, maybe not totally unsecure because you were around. So they were unsecure. So the smell of the air was different. The noise was different. People maybe behaved different. And at least that was an assumption. But it went away after 1 week. So after 1 week, they feel well with the situation. They adapt to it. And at that point, I would describe that besides the surface, people understand they are more similar than different. Okay, if you think about the work culture and European and Chinese work culture, I would describe it. I have had to work together with young people at that time, including myself, also assigned to be young. And for sure, you have then a different kind of thinking, what you want to reach and how you want to reach it, in what kind of time. I personally have had not seen too many people who can be productive more than 10 hours a day, and also not they cannot be productive than 7 days a week. So there is a limitation. If you would decide to work more than 10 hours a day, you might can be present, but you cannot work. So that's some physical facts I somehow have experience on myself as well as on others. So it's just difficult. And then if you assume work culture there and here, we try to be a culture of experts and get our added value to have a high degree of having an expertise. If you start in China, this kind of expertise for each individual might be not general, very developed. So that means for sure you have to develop it together with the people. You have had excellent people in China, in Shanghai at that time, who stand out because at that time the system was very selective in who could progress and who not. So I experienced the interaction with a person. And he has had also a PhD, and his PhD number in China was below 10,000. So for every PhD you make at that time, you get a number. And the PhD number was below 10,000, which also tells you something about to whom you were posed. And So everybody was involved, everybody was engaged, everybody was willing to learn. Maybe learning was even more important than contributing at that time, but that was also okay because, as I describe it, and as you also describe it, how fast China was developing at that time, where our European culture might have spent 200 years and they might have spent 30 years in reaching this, reflects a little bit how developed our economy is to bring added value to people on one side, and also to if you invest in education, and there was the setup of China was, I would describe it, very clever to invest in education, and the portion of education and investing education from the personal household at that time, for if you put it on in the relationship, what you earn was 40 to 60%. So 40 to 60% of all your income was not going in food, travel, or whatever. It was education, and that gives you also a little bit a mindset of the people. If you say, "Oh, how was working at that time?" So they were really seeking education, understanding that the education brings them forward. And with such kind of attitude, for sure, you can develop a whole society as well as also individuals.
I agree to that. Education is very highly regarded, I think, still in China. And what I saw in the last years before the pandemic was very impressive, how they presented very boldly what they want to achieve in the coming 5 to 10 years. And I remember the slogan that China wants to become the innovation leader. And many people understood the value of education and learning more and more every day, but also on the investment side. And I think in the last years, I was a little bit surprised that the government is a little bit, in my opinion, hammering down on education and investments. And I wonder how the next years will look like, because the companies they created, like Alibaba, like Tencent, but also on the pharmaceutical side, I mean, Fosun Pharma, for example, or Sinopharm, are tremendous successes and doing very well. And I'm surprised a little bit about the turn of the Chinese government. How do you see that?
There is for sure a challenge about how to develop a society and in which kind of direction you want to develop it. So think about Japan and what is the demand of Japanese people to spend and stay involved in their professional life in comparison with their family life. What political leaders understood is you have to create also jobs for all this kind of well-educated persons. And on the other side, if you think about, there is still a lot of families with only child. So there is a pressure on only childs, where some of the only childs, as well as the families, might cannot stand it. And then you have to give also a signal maybe towards your society. Hey, guys, it's okay if we are trying to get as much knowledge into our brain as possible, but maybe we have to think about what does it make with us and how to set up a culture which is also sustainable. Yeah, and we have also the same question to answer in our Middle European society. So our societies are also not sustainable if you would look like how much children we allow ourselves to get raised here in Germany, Austria, and how to make this kind of work-life balance possible, that at least I would describe it that our societies are sustainable. So we extract a lot of resources from what we should bring into education that more the elderly people are profiting from it. So it's a little bit like the same like as a CEO of a company. You can be tremendously successful in the first years if you cut R&D, because then you don't spend any money. You will have a high profit margin there, but after 3 or 4 years not spending R&D, also your company will crash down. So describing this kind of challenge that Chinese society as well as the European society has, and they are, again, sorry then for my mindset, I try to identify similarities first before I go to differences.
That's great. I come from the other side, so... We meet in the middle then.
and this somehow you see now. So for me, it was also interesting to see. But for sure, I also have opposed to children who went through all this kind of educational accelerators, I would describe it. And for sure, you have them then as colleagues and need to deal with them again. Maybe I have also a sense for only child. Because I'm by myself and only children, so maybe that helps me in Shanghai, I don't know. So I think they are thinking what is our picture in the future about society? How should we set it up? That maybe something like happiness is a key asset about how we run our society.
I couldn't agree more. I was always impressed when I traveled there. One hand, the speed of the development of the cities, which were really visible from one year to the other, a lot of new buildings. The cultural differences were set similarities. In the end, before the pandemic, I saw a lot of commonalities. It was so easy to get in touch, and even it was like not leaving the country. So, of course, I mean, it was China. But talking to people, English, in my opinion, was well understood by many people. There was no communication problem anymore. Also, the gadgets made it fairly easy to understand. So like the Apple iPhone, which could translate Chinese letters very easily, and just holding it, and I could read what's there. So as I said, I mean, the similarities became bigger and the differences became less, and I hope that one day the pandemic also ends and that we can continue on that path, because I think it's really a great one. And the thing is with China, I think there is a lot of talents there, and people are very proficient in moving things forward, and it's the biggest market pretty soon, I'm for sure. So I think the Chinese success story will continue. And what you describe with the quest for happiness, I think the government will just do it as successfully as they did the other developments in the last 30 years since the Berlin Wall fell. So China is an interesting market. Connecting with the Chinese society is an interesting mission. And maybe one or the other listeners thinks about setting up also operations somewhere in Beijing or in Shanghai or in Hong Kong. What advice would you give as a final question, such entrepreneurs who are inspired by your our conversation and by your explanation? What is a proper first step into the Chinese market?
You have to assume yourself about what are your success criteria. I have been opposed to a lot of people who somehow came to China and think it's different now, so I have to act different, and then they fail. So you would not expect, if you go to US for 1 week and find the partner of your lifetime, if you go to US. But too often I have seen that people are expecting that if they go to China for whatever reason. So don't change. I have to say, make yourself aware why you were successful, and don't change your successful criteria. If you go to China, as I indicated previously, you have to have the feeling that you got wanted Don't try to fight an uphill battle. Yeah. If you don't have the feeling you are wanted. Yeah. Not your money is wanted. Something else is wanted. If you have the feeling you got wanted, then it's a place where you should decide it to go. China by itself is so different. It's like Europe. So you might find it, and that is what you need to figure out. You might find an ecosystem, an environment which fits to you, and you might find it in Beijing. Or you might find it in Peking, Shanghai, or Hong Kong, but they are different. It's the same difference if you think about you can come along very well and you enjoy it to have conversation with Italian people and others like more Swedish people to interact, and some like East German, European culture more than Portuguese culture. And this highly diverse cultural differences, you have to be aware that you have it also in China. China is not this kind of one monolith country like people assume to, and that you need to find out. And there you need to have time. And this kind of investment of time is underestimated. So you cannot say, hey, I start something and then I run away. So I described already that in the first 10 years, every 6 to 8 weeks, we have had a physical presence there. So that means I have been there 4 to 6 times a year for a period of 2 weeks to 6 weeks. And if you are not willing to invest such kind of time in it, action that might be then also not appropriated, yeah, or you have to ask others to execute it, yeah. But don't think you can be successfully executing something where you don't invest time. And for sure, people, as I describe it, you need to get the feeling if you would want it or not. And for sure, people also enjoy personal interaction, like you enjoy personal interaction also with your format there, yeah. With different kind of people, this kind of enjoyment you have to also create there.
That was a great explanation. I think I will remember a lot of great things from our conversation, like thinking more about similarities than differences in the world, and trying to find first what we have in common, and then talk about where we are different. It's, I think, very inspiring, and it's great approach to life, and probably will help making life better. Kai, thank you very much for giving your valuable insights at my podcast, and I'm looking forward to catch up probably next year.
Please, yes. Christian, thanks a lot.
Have a great day. Bye.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.